My name is Judith Payne, and I am an alcoholic. And right off the bat, you've taken away my security blanket. There's no podium up here. As I was sitting there, I was thinking, what I'm going to do is I'm going to walk up there and take the microphone in my hand and start walking across the floor here in the front. I guess Oklahoma breeds storytellers, and I want to tell you the story about bamboo. In a garden, a beautiful garden in the east, there stood a stately bamboo tree. And bamboo had beautiful branches that lifted up to gather together the sunlight. And in the breeze, she swayed and she danced. And one day, the master gardener came to Bamboo and said, "Bamboo, I have a use for you." And she was very excited, because that was the first time that the gardener had ever talked to her. And secretly, she had always wanted to do something other than exist in her own self-centeredness. But the master gardener said, "First, I must cut off your branches." And Bamboo was a little bit edgy about that. You know, "You're going to cut off my branches? Those are the things that I use to reach up to the sunlight with. Those are the things that people comment on." But the master said, "In order for you to be useful to me, I must cut off your branches." And Bamboo acquiesced, and the master cut off her branches. And then the master said, "Bamboo, in order for you to be useful to me, I must chop you down." And Bamboo was horrified. "Chop me down? Then I won't be able to see anything, and then no one will be able to see me." But the master gardener said, "In order for you to be useful, I must chop you down." And Bamboo acquiesced, and she was chopped down. And then the master gardener said, "Bamboo, I must split you open and tear out your heart." And Bamboo was terrified. But she agreed, and the master gardener split her open and tore out her heart. And she felt as if there were nothingness there. And then the master gardener took her and placed her from a stream in the upper part of the garden, and water flowed through her to the lower part of the garden. And the garden flourished, and Bamboo felt useful. And I hope that I will be your Bamboo tonight. Page 29 in the big book, there is a solution. It says, "Each individual in their personal stories describes in his own language and from his own point of view the way he established his relationship with God." And that's what I want to share with you tonight. When I was 2 years old, my natural father died, and my mother remarried at about age six. And I went from Judy Ray Grubb to Judith Ann Nieberlein. And the change in the name signifies the change in the family and the change in a beginning point of where my outsides were not matching my insides. I believe that my first higher power was my mother. And much as I tried, I never quite got her complete approval. Making good grades in school pleased her, and consequently I was very good at that. But everything else was a rash of rebellion. The man that she married, my stepfather, became my second higher power. And early on, I learned at age, probably 15 to 17, that rebellion and defiance and misbehavior also were a creation of power. And I sought those activities. I met alcohol and drugs at age 17 and felt comfortable at that point, because it was an epitome of misbehavior. You know, nice girls don't do these things. I was asked to leave prestigious girls' schools on two different occasions, and finally my behavior warranted my father kicking me out of the house. And it was probably one of the bravest things that my father ever did, and I respect him for that today. As I was walking in the treatment center this evening, you know, I had one of those pang feelings one more time, and the feeling was like, you know, I hope they're not going to keep me. I want to digress a little bit and tell you about my experience of Salt Lake City so far, now that I'm a little bit more comfortable. I'm real familiar with my own history. The first night that we got here, I was dressed as I am now, and we were walking down Temple South. And there was a man coming up the other side of the road, and he had gray hair. He's about 65 years old, and his pants were real baggy, and his the cuff of his pants were all rolled up, you know, and he had on an oversized shirt, and he had a brown bottle in his hand, you know, and I recognize a fellow brother. And he was kind of stumbling along there, you know, and looking at the ground. And pretty soon he looked up and he saw me. And it registered, you know, and his eyes cleared. And he said, "You're just dressed up pretty as a Valentine." And I fell in love. I have always had an affinity for drunks, and it doesn't matter whether they're sober or not. My second night here, same location, approximately, there were three young people, two females and a male, and they were avant-garde dressed, and it was the night that it was raining here, and the two girls were having the time of their life, you know, and the guy was waiting for them. I mean, he'd get up to the stop sign, the girls would be twiddling along. And they had umbrellas, and they were actually dancing around their umbrellas in the rain singing songs. And I thought, wow, you know, what a happy town. Now, I perceived that those people were sober. Maybe so, maybe not. We're staying downtown, and there's a couple of Oklahoma ski addicts. There's not a lot of skiing in Oklahoma. In fact, our local t-shirts say, got a picture of an oil derrick on the front and a skier going down the side, and it says, "Ski Oklahoma." In our group that's skiing with us, there are four other fellows who are enjoying, they're enjoying life, you know, and they're enjoying their consumption of whiskey. And we have these votes early in the morning about where it is that we're going to ski. And I'm proud to say that the two sober alcoholics have been able to grandly manipulate the other parties. And we've actually gotten to go where we wanted to every day. And since Larry doesn't get to talk again here, he doesn't get to make any rebuttal on these statements. Yesterday I was feeling really bad because, you see, I couldn't talk these fellas that were enjoying their drinking into coming here tonight. And my sensitivity was hurt that they wouldn't give up their drinking to come here. But it just didn't work out that way. I've also been to the to listen to the Tabernacle Choir. And I'm glad that the name of your meeting is Came to Believe. Because two big time things have happened to me here. And I believe that the whole point of this program for me is coming to believe. To believe that God can do for me that which I cannot do for myself. Not only with regard to alcoholism, but with regard to the other 99 problems that it's taken me several years to start working on. In the tabernacle, I closed my eyes, and I had a directive, you know. It's like when I came to you in this program, I didn't have any beliefs. I did not have any standards of behavior. The higher power, which first taught me about God, gave me a lot of book knowledge about God. And we did Bible studies, and I went to that church's schools, and I learned a lot of technical stuff. The church taught me what to do, but it has been Alcoholics Anonymous that has taught me how to do it. Whenever my behavior interfered or was different than that which I was been taught, I changed my yardstick. In sobriety, it's been very difficult for me because, you know, it's like, how do you act? You know, is this okay? Is this not okay? What am I supposed to be doing today? And a lot of us check things out with our sponsors, and I do that. And for a number of years in the program, I didn't travel anywhere without my sponsor. You know, and you'll be glad to know that I've only called her once since I've been here. And that was shortly before I came this evening. My intentions were always to be good at what I did, to be good to you, but it never really turned out that way. In establishing what it is that I believe in, and the thing that happened to me in the tabernacle was an establishment of what is sexual behavior, acceptable sexual behavior for me. By the amazing grace of God and the fellowship of this program, I've not had any mood-altering chemicals or alcohol since April the 10th of 1980. But I've had a lot of other stuff, okay? To feed on my addiction to my own adrenaline. I am absolutely addicted to a high. Some people just enjoy skiing, and other people have to have rock music blaring in their ears while they're skiing. And I'm that second kind. The Big Book talks about that we all need a sexual overhauling. And I didn't intend for this necessarily to come up, but since we're on it. Since we're on it, I was not necessarily a lady when I was drinking. And I would characterize my sex life drinking as the best of Hustler magazine. And I was unable to separate fantasy from reality. And it was one of those deals where if you could think about it, you might as well do it. That was a carryover from that higher power that taught me about God also. I participated in group sexual activities, animalistic sexual activities, voyeurism. And so, see, when you get a list like that, you know, for me to tell you that I was unfaithful to my husband, it's kind of insignificant. I want you to know that all of us have skeletons in our closet, okay? And yours may not be the same kind of mine as mine, but they do the same thing to your soul, you know? And as Larry said Wednesday, you don't have to have done the same things that I did. But I know that you've experienced the same feelings. When I was sitting in a treatment center like this 6 years ago in 1980, there was a fellow there who shared about having sex with a sheep. And I thought that that was really rude. And I was really offended that they would talk about something like that in a treatment center. And I was there 45 days, so I got to hear the guy more than once. And the second time he talked, he shared about the same thing, you know? And I decided, hey, this guy is a pervert, you know? He gets his jollies out of trying to shock people. It has been since that time that I have learned that that which I put out here does not harm my soul. That which I keep inside of me is what has always torn me up. Therefore, if I can share with you statements about my behavior, you know, it's no longer in me, and it's out there. Due to that kind of a sexual life, and an example, I want to give you an example of Al-Anonism. One of the people mentioned that maybe we could have gone to an Al-Anon meeting when we went to Huggy Bear's last night, and you see, I didn't even think about going to an Al-Anon meeting, you know? You know, it's like when alcoholics get to AA, they get to work on alcohol. But when Al-Anons get to Al-Anon, they have to work on themselves. And you see, it's taken me several years to learn, hey, pain, it's time to be looking at yourself and to be working on yourself. When I first got to this program, I decided that celibacy was appropriate. I believe that for me, sexual activity is the closest thing to a person's soul. And that the activity that I had participated in had raped that soul, you know. It had just kind of shriveled up and gone to nothingness. The example of Al-Anonism, when I was married, and in the voyeur activities, at one occasion it did not quite work out the way it was planned, and everybody was coked up, and my husband ended up beating up the gentleman that I was with, broke 3 ribs and broke a nose. And the police officers came, you know, and there's all these people standing around out of their gourd. I was naked with blood all over me, watching a man beat on another man who was not defending himself. And the police came and said, "We will take you away." And my response was, "No, I will stay with my husband." And that is an example of the depth of my Al-Anon addiction. My husband replaced my father in my life as a higher power. Again, when I came to this program, I decided that celibacy was appropriate, and I decided that with my sponsor. And I remained celibate for 5 years in this program, and I know that it's recommended that we not do anything major for a period of 1 year and that we stay out of relationships, and that's excellent, you know. In the book, the doctor alcoholic addict talks about that he had used up his right to chemical peace of mind. And I have not only used up my right to chemical peace of mind, but I had also used up my right to sexual peace of mind. For me, that was what was necessary. During which time, though, you know, the mind operates, and I would watch all this 13-stepping going on, and it infuriated me. You know, whenever a man left with a woman at a meeting, I knew what they were going to go do. I found it very difficult to have friends that had male friends, you know. And the people that I chose to date were, anything but the epitome of masculinity. And the sixth step is dealing with character defects, and mine had a great deal to do with judgmentalness, you know. And I knew that all of these people were doing stuff that they should not be doing because it was not okay for me, therefore it was not okay with them. And my celibacy was broken with an affair with a married minister. And God has a real funny way of doing things. Now, I'd like to stand before you and tell you that I was drunk, you know. But you see, reality is that when you're drinking, you may have brief periods of sobriety followed by still worse relapses. Well, in sobriety, you may have brief relapses followed by better periods of sobriety. And that was one of my relapses. I know the meaning of judge not, lest ye be judged. I know what that is for me today. The fourth step also talks about, and by the way, I've resumed my old status because it seems to work. The fourth step talks about, it talks about resentments, fear, and sex. You know, three big areas with me. The resentments had to do with a lot of anger with people not doing the things that I thought that they ought to be doing. The fear examination, and I wrote a separate fourth step on each of these, the fear examination, amazingly enough, had to do with fear of death and fear of having to take care of an old aunt and fear of losing my son, who is 8 years old. The other thing that has happened to me since I've been in Salt Lake City, and it happened at, I went to another church tonight, was a, actually the little preface occurred, we went to group 2, Monday or Tuesday night or something when we first got here, and they were kind of doing a eulogy with someone who had died earlier, And I was pretty moved at that meeting. Now, I was moved because a mentor of mine who had 37 years of sobriety had passed away. And I have a tendency to get very angry at God when he takes away people that my sobriety depends on. You know, and he had already taken away one sponsor, and here he was taking away this other guy. And it was nice to hear people sharing about this man's sobriety. Today, though, I had a strong sense of Roy R., whom none of you know, and it's not material, being with me, you know? And it's like the fear of death left, and the belief that, you know, this is a piece of heaven, and that there is a greater piece of heaven out there came to me. And for that, I am truly grateful. My seeking, you know, there was a constant question as to what's it all about? Is this all there is? And frankly, I was most of the time bored, absolutely bored with life. I was attracted to high-powered drugs. Stayed on crystal methadrine for a period of 3 years, attended law school while I was on crystal methadrine, and I was absolutely brilliant. You know, I could never get my mouth to talk fast enough or my hand to write fast enough to keep up with my brain, you know, but I knew that it was there. I remember going one time to the restroom during an exam period to do more speed because I was weakening, and I had a thought there in the bathroom, you know, is this what it's about? Is this it? And I probably only had three or four of those thoughts during the entire time that I was using. One occurred in the police scene that I told you about. One occurred then. I was in jail in Los Angeles, California, in a padded cell, stripped down naked. Which is not the typical place, you know, that they put somebody who's dressed up like a Valentine. And I thought at that time, is this what it's about? Is this it? Women get married. I tried that. Women have children. I also tried that. In 1978, I had my one and only son. And I'm really excellent at reading books. And so consequently, my method of doing anything is to read a book and figure out that's how I follow the steps in the book. And the book said two things. Fetal alcohol syndrome is caused by women drinking alcohol who are pregnant. Therefore, don't drink when you're pregnant. And children don't remember anything until they're 2 years old. So my brilliant alcoholic mind decided you do not drink while you're pregnant. You continue to smoke pot and do cocaine, but no drinking. And the other is, I don't even have to worry about getting sober until my child is 2 years old. You know, which kind of put us on a 1980 timetable there. I had to be hospitalized at 7 months of pregnancy because I was a phenomena unknown to medical science. I went from 135 pounds to 205 pounds and was still ballooning. And I didn't have the heart to tell the doctor, have you ever heard of marijuana munchies? They had to keep me in the hospital. And that was the only way that they could handle the situation. You know, one of my traumatic fourth steps was with regard to my son. He weighed 3 pounds when he was born. And due to my drug usage, the villi in the placenta were having heart attacks, and they were dying. And they were killing the life that was in me. During the time, the next 2 years, my son lived with two people who were drinking, you know. And so when it rolls around to 1980, the time when children start remembering what's going on, it's time to get sober. So how do you go about getting sober? You go to Al-Anon. And I started going to Al-Anon and going out after Al-Anon. And I went to educational seminars about alcoholism because I had to do something about this man in my life who was drinking too much. And this man was playing Russian roulette with a revolver, and he was wrecking cars, and he was not coming home at night. And so we did an intervention on him, and we sent him to treatment. And I was so pleased with myself. I started searching the house for all the drugs he'd hidden, and found quite a bit. Went up to his family week in Mandan, North Dakota, treatment center much like this one. And on Tuesday of family week, one of those counselors pointed a finger at me, you know, and his statement was real simple. He said, you are an alcoholic. And praise God for my feeling at that moment. It was a sense of relief, you know? It was a sense of relief by way, whew, somebody else knows. And it started feeling okay. There's a drunk that was walking up and down the, came out of a bar and was walking down the street, and he had one foot up on the curb and the other foot down in the gutter, causes one to kind of walk like this, you know. And the cop came by, and the cop said, buddy, you're drunk. And the guy said, oh, wow, that's great. I thought I was crippled. I felt good when somebody told me I was an alcoholic. It seemed to be okay, because everybody in the treatment center was into alcoholism, you know? I mean, if you were an alcoholic in a treatment center, you were somebody. They kept, you know, in a 30-day program, and you have to stay 45 days. A bit of trouble I had in treatment. The first time that they let me out, they'd let you go out on shopping tours, you know, for an hour on Saturday. The first time that I went out shopping, I bought 17 pairs of shoes. And the nurses have to go through all of these boxes, you know, when they get them back to the place to look for drugs. And they were doing that, you know, and they called my counselor, and my counselor told them to tell me to wait until Monday, you know. And I knew the meaning of fear, wait until Monday. Monday, she told me to return the shoes. Returning things and making amends to people have been, you know, a great learning event for me, you know. And I should have learned a lot when I had to return the shoes, but it just didn't quite work that way. Out of treatment, I went to my first AA meeting, and I was absolutely petrified. And a man had to come over to my car, and he pecked on the window with his finger, and he said, are you here for AA? You know, and a lot of things went through my mind that moment. Because although I knew I was an alcoholic, I wasn't too dead sure that I wanted to do a damn thing about it. I was, what, 30 years old? I had enough health and enough money to last at least another good 10 years. And the crazy thing is, I had never tried to quit drinking. And, you know, we talk about people try to quit drinking and they've got to fail before they're driven to the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. I came here in a great deal of pain, but I had never tried to quit drinking. I absolutely operated on terror of a treatment center for the first year of my sobriety. And even though we came in the back door here, you know, there's still that old sense when you're walking into a hospital, and the same thing Wednesday night. After about a year and a half of sobriety, an event happened which led me to believe that I was truly an alcoholic. Now in Oklahoma, they teach us not to do anything the first year except say sober. And I didn't follow the rules, and I was trying to mow my grass. And I was put my hand in the back of the lawnmower to try to get the gummed up grass out and cut off a finger. And it's okay. And there was just a fountain of blood, you know, and the pain was pretty severe. And my very first thought was, this is it. This is going to get me some drugs. I didn't look for the finger, I didn't care about it, but you got to go to the hospital, right, and talk to a doctor in order to get drugs. And this is at a year and a half sobriety. And this is at going to meetings and working the steps and having a sponsor. And the thought did not leave me. You know, the book says that we have a mental obsession, an obsession. And once we ingest that stuff, then we have a phenomena of craving. My neighbors took me to the hospital, and the next time in my life that I became really irritated with my higher power was when the doctor did not offer me any drugs over that finger. And you see, it was nothing that I did that warranted that. When the name of your meeting says, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could do, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity, it was, you know, it was like my God was doing that for me, you know, because I had drugs on the brain, and I was on a roll, and I was ready to go. When that happened, I knew in my heart that I was an alcoholic. And the process in Alcoholics Anonymous has been slow to get things from Judith's head down to her tummy. That's when it happened for me by way of knowing that I was an alcoholic. Three events happened within a period of about 4 months. The second event was a wet dream, an alcohol dream, okay? The dream involved a grocery store, and they had a new product. Excuse me, the name of the product was called Instaboos. And it was a dry powder form that came in a little, metal type sack, and all you had to do was add water and you had scotch. And I was shopping in the grocery store, and I was throwing this stuff in my basket, you know. And I opened the groceries, paid for my stuff, and opened the doors, and it's raining outside, you know. And it was like I was in hog heaven. And I then had a sense of drowning and woke up, you know. It was like an overpowering sense of drowning. And the minute that I woke up, I could not tell you whether I had been drinking or not been drinking. You know, for that first fleeting second after one of those dreams, I believed that I was drunk. And it scared me. It absolutely terrified me. The third instance, I went out with some business associates, male, and I have a real hard time competing with the boys. And they were drinking, and so I ordered a virgin peach daiquiri. And everybody's drink came, and I took a sip of my virgin peach daiquiri, and it was just fire in my veins. Fire in my veins. My toenails started pulsating, and the roots on my hair were just on flame. And the thing that I knew so clearly, instantly, was the thought that went through my head, nobody will ever know if I finish this drink. It was at that point, after those three events, that I was absolutely, positively convinced that I was an alcoholic. I believe that there are two kinds of us. Those of us who come in Alcoholics Anonymous and stay sober from the very first day and we're convinced that we're alcoholic from the very first day. And then there are the other people who come in, stay sober, go back out, test it, come back in, stay sober, and go back out and test it. You know, and since I have been kind number one, the grass always looks greener on the other side of the fence, and I think that kind number two has it better. But I thank God for those three instances, for those events happening in my life, so that I know for sure. I believe that what I learned in treatment was honesty. And they took us through the first five steps. But the thing, the quality that I learned, you know, was honesty. And in the doctor's opinion in the beginning of the book, it talks about, you know, that we no longer know truth from falsehood. The thing that I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous was that God will restore me to sanity. And that's the whole point of it, to get from being alcoholic to being restored to sanity. And the way, you know, it's almost like steps 3 through 12, all they have to do with is getting to the end of step 2, believing that God can do this for me. Our first or second day on the ski slopes and beset with a bit of fear, you know. It's like I've been afraid of heights for years, and consequently skiing and the lifts are a real trip for me. And, you know, the immediate reaction is to ask God's help with that. And believing that God can assist me with other things other than my alcoholism. Somewhere in the big book it talks about, I don't know if it talks about chocolate or milkshakes, one. But, you know, in my treatment center, they taught us how to go to the ice cream store. And I went to the ice cream store a lot when I got sober. And I spent a great deal of my sobriety weighing 236 pounds and above. And I've spent a great deal of my sobriety wearing only blacks and browns and navy blues. And so you see, for a drunk coming down the street to recognize me as a Valentine really touched my soul. Because one of the gifts that God has given me is release from an obsession with food and release from a lot of weight. And I was regretted that Larry didn't tell you about not smoking. One of the things that I prayed for in step 6 and 7 over and over and over again was to be released from this obsession with food. And, you know, it's like God does things on his own timetable and not on my timetable. And I remember being at a conference in a canyon, and there was a little chapel there, and I was in there just praying my soul out, you know, just working real hard at it. And I left the chapel feeling all so good, you know, and I knew he'd done it. Ooh, it just felt like he'd done it for sure, you know. And what he took away was smoking, not food. Consequently, since 1982, September the 19th, I've not had any cigarettes. But you see, that wasn't on my agenda, you know. So sometimes I have to work real hard at being grateful for that. I want to tell you some things about, you know, this discovery, okay, the how to do it. Not what to do, but how to do it. The higher power that I believe in today, whom I choose to call God, is very dependable, very consistent. And I've not known very many things that were dependable and consistent in my life. And almost invariably, if I do the things that I'm supposed to be doing, things will work out okay. And I heard the very same words from my sponsor, you know, this evening. You know, did you pray and meditate? Have you gone to meetings? Are you going, calling your sponsor? Well, if you did, then everything's going to be okay. Don't worry about it. And that's a true statement. My God is also invigorating. You know, I get a lot of energy from my higher power. About 2 months ago, my sponsor suggested that I go to an alcoholism counseling place, and I went there, and they gave me a test, and I came back for another meeting, and the results of the test were that I was histrionic with a narcissistic overlay. Well, now, being an educated person, I had to have a book to look that up in. So I asked that counselor, well, now let's look it up together. And so we looked it up together, you know, and what that meant was histrionic is a person who gets hysterical, you know, and I was pretty offended at being called hysterical. You know, it's kind of like you overreact to life and you overreact to drunks on the street and you overreact to people that you ski with, and that bugged me. Narcissism. That's the person who looks in the pond and say, oh, aren't we doing good today? Now, that kind of fit, you know. But the end of that session, oh, the other characteristic of histrionic is suicidal, you know, and I'm not suicidal. I quit drinking. Don't worry about it. I'm not suicidal. No matter that I drive cars at 90 miles an hour, have been to class to teach you how to drive, and I was 33 years old and everybody else was 16. The last time that I was in court over my driving, the judge said, you've used it up, Payne. You have used up all of your favors. The next time you are going to have to do time in jail. Can you imagine an attorney doing time in jail for driving offenses? The bottom line of the diagnosis was, you're sick. You're out of touch with reality, you are dishonest, and you are in immediate need of 30 days inpatient treatment. And that lady had one hostile alcoholic on her hand. Those people had affronted the two things that were critical to me, honesty and humility. And I was infuriated. I went to three meetings a day for 3 days, and finally at one of those meetings, one of the old guys said, well now, you know, it kind of reminds me of an old song Porgy and Bess used to do. Name of that song was, It Ain't Necessarily So. And I had a sense of relief at that point. You know, but I still had this big, huge reservation. It was recommended to me prior to checking in for that 30 days of treatment that I go, that I try being quiet. Being quiet. The very first prayer that I ever learned to say in Alcoholics Anonymous was, slow me down and calm my fears. It's a current popular song out now that talks about a freight train running through your head. And I know what that freight train is. For most of the time, for 3 or 4 years into sobriety, I felt like one of those little wind-up toys, you know. And somebody'd wind me up and I'd just go, 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 go. And then they'd wind me up again, you know. And it's not very balanced, you know, and it's not very calm, and it's not very serene. It's what some people refer to as the peaks and the valleys, but I didn't understand being quiet. I did not understand being in that place where only God is. The book tells me that the great reality is within. And it's a funny place for him to be, because I looked for him who would have thought that he was hiding there? I looked for him in a lot of other things. Looked for him in the alcohol, in the drugs, in the men, in the sex. Looked for him in fast cars. You know, I looked for God in shopping sprees. I am one of those people, you've seen the shopping carts sitting in a dime store that's all loaded up, you know, and nobody claims it. My cart. Walk into Walmart, TG&Y, Target, throw things in that basket left and right, get that sense of guilt, go over to an aisle where nobody's around, leave the cart. You know, when we talk about using up chemical peace of mind, I used up my shopping peace of mind. I've had to do three things about that. Number one, not go in a Target, TG&Y, and Walmart, and I don't know what your dime stores are, but those are the names of ours. And I made it a full 366 days without darkening their door. Two, we're talking about a physical cut-up of all credit cards, all of them. and it pained my soul to see that last credit card go. And, you know, a typical example, I had a justification for it. When we checked in the hotel downtown Salt Lake, what did they ask you for? A credit card. You know, they don't want to see green cash. And the third thing that I have had to do is what I would call alternate taker. And what that has to do with is every other time I've got to say no. And I don't care what it is, whether it's an apple, orange juice, a fur coat, Tampax, you know. Every other time something goes through my head that I need, I have to say no. No, I simply cannot do that. One of the other things that's been lifted from me is my fear of heights, you know, and that's been a beautiful experience. I was going to tell you about the being silent thing. When I first came to this program,